Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. 23 detained in raids and a mastermind identified.
It happens very fast, and we don't know exactly how to deal with those feelings we have.
Lucy Vaudin is a resident of Paris. She, along with thousands across Paris today, across the world, are trying to reconcile the senseless horror story that took place in her city on Friday night. French authorities have detained 23 people in police raids across the country in the aftermath of Friday's attacks, as authorities say they've identified the suspected mastermind behind the deadly assault. A Belgian national of Moroccan descent, his name is Abdelhamid Aboud. He was named as the possible lead plotter of the attacks that killed 129 people. Belgium authorities had sought Aboud earlier this year for a foiled terror attack on police. French police have also released a photo of the suspect who's still at large from the Friday night attacks. Lisa Bryant files this report from Paris for VOA.
As French strikes destroyed Islamic State group sites in the Syrian city of Raqqa Sunday night, French police carried out dozens of raids in several towns across the country. French and Belgian police are also trying to track down 26-year-old Salah Abdeslam, the suspected eighth assailant in Friday's terrorist attacks that killed at least 129 people around Paris. Speaking on the radio Monday morning, French Prime Minister Manuel Valls said authorities are aware that more attacks were being prepared. He said raids are being carried out to question people who support radical Islam and advocate hatred for the French Republic. ISIS has claimed responsibility for Friday's attacks, and French authorities say the multiple strikes were prepared abroad with assailants mobilized in Belgium with possible complicity in France. Lisa Bryant, Paris.
This is VOA News. A new video attributed to the Islamic State is warning of a Paris-style attack on Washington. The video, appearing on social media Monday, threatened all countries involved in military operations against the militant group, saying they will suffer the same fate as France. The person speaking in the video specifically singled out the U.S. capital city. Quoting here, "To all the countries that participated in the Crusader campaign in a day or sooner or later, they will face a day just like what France faced. Now we demolished France in their own backyard in Paris. We swear by the order of God we will destroy America in their own heart in Washington." VOA cannot independently verify the authenticity of the video. There has been no comment from U.S. officials. The Catholic Church may be losing members in parts of the world, but you wouldn't know it by attending a packed service at Soweto's Regina Mundi Church. The cavernous inside of South Africa's largest Catholic church can accommodate up to 7,000 people, and many Sundays it makes good on that space. Anita Powell has more for VOA.
This is the sound of the Catholic Church in Africa. The church has grown a whopping 238% in Africa since 1980. That growth has eclipsed other regions, especially Europe, where the Catholic population has grown just 6% in that same time. The study attributes the huge difference mainly to fertility. But population numbers do not tell the whole story, says Father Reginald Anthony.
There's an ongoing connection in Africa with the spirit world and with God. So evangelization through the gospel has simply deepened that in many cases.
As Pope Francis prepares to make his historic visit to the continent, all Catholic eyes will be on him. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. Myanmar opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi attended the closing session of the current parliament on Monday. Her party, the National League for Democracy, recently won a landslide victory over the government and military-backed Union Solidarity and Development Party and captured an absolute majority of the seats in the new parliament. Under a clause implemented into the constitution by the then ruling military junta, Aung San Suu Kyi is barred from becoming a president because her sons are citizens of a foreign country. Both are British, as was her late husband. However, she said if her party was victorious in the recent election, she would be the one telling the newly selected president what to do. Monday's parliamentary session was the last one under Thein Sein's presidency, whose USDP received a drubbing from the NLD. Joe Palca in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Unfortunately, some people are, I guess, drawing the false conclusions that somehow the refugee flows represents an increased terrorist threat for Europe or for France. We firmly believe that the evidence, in fact, shows quite the opposite.
That's Bruno Stagno of Human Rights Watch talking about reaction to Friday's terrorist attacks in Paris. Details coming up.
Also, at least four people died in shootings and explosions in several neighborhoods in Burundi's capital yesterday, and a senior United Nations official is warning of a potential migration crisis in the Sahel region of Africa.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from the DRC, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the French news agency reports that Nigerian army says it has foiled an attack on the northeastern city of Maiduguri. An army spokesman says nine members of the Boko Haram militant group entered the city with automatic weapons and homemade bombs. No other details are available at this time as to what happened to the suspected terrorist or how the army foiled the attack. The capital of Borno State has been a frequent target of attacks this year. AFP reports at least 265 people have died in suicide and bomb attacks.
A senior United Nations official is warning of a potential migration crisis in the Sahel region of Africa because of conflict, climate change, abject poverty, and a lack of opportunity for young people at home. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United Nations says the Sahel countries are among the nations most at risk for crises and disasters. It reports more than 24 million people in the nine Sahelian countries are expected to suffer from moderate to severe hunger next year. It warns about 750,000 children across the region will lose their lives because of malnutrition-related causes. Toby Lanzer, the regional humanitarian coordinator for the Sahel, says he is particularly worried about worsening conditions for millions of people living around the Lake Chad Basin. He says many communities in Niger, Nigeria, Chad, and Cameroon depend on the lake for their livelihoods, noting it has shrunk to a small proportion of its original size over the last 50 years. He says this is putting enormous pressure upon these communities and increasing social tensions. Besides being one of the world's climate change hotspots, he says the region is beset by conflict, violence, and massive displacement due to Nigeria's Boko Haram militants. He says the Nigerian government has made recent gains by reining in Boko Haram, but that this has only served to have the group change its tactics and increase the number of suicide bombings by children as young as seven. He says 2.5 million people have been displaced as a result of Boko Haram violence and counterinsurgency operations by the four countries. He says many are migrating to other countries out of desperation.
And I think, to be fair, we should not cast what is happening in Lake Chad Basin as an immediate contributor to the issue of migration vis-a-vis Europe. That would not be fair. However, is that something that could be on the cards? Absolutely. At the moment, 20% of people arriving in Europe from Africa are from Nigeria.
Lanzer says they are not from areas affected by Boko Haram, but adds the situation could change rapidly and would not be surprised to see more people victimized by Boko Haram heading for Europe to seek asylum. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
France fell silent today to observe the deaths of 129 people who died Friday night in multiple terrorist attacks in Paris. The attacks left 350 people wounded. Police have arrested 23 suspects and continue with raids on suspected militants across the nation. However, they have failed to capture a suspect they describe as the Syrian-based mastermind of the attacks. France is also waging a bombing campaign against Islamic State targets in Syria. Meanwhile, efforts continue to tie the terrorist attacks to Europe's wave of more than 700,000 migrants, primarily from the Middle East. Meanwhile, a new government in Poland has taken office today in Warsaw and says it may not honor the quota commitments of the previous Warsaw administration. The new foreign minister says that after the terrorist attacks on Paris on Friday, Poland would need security guarantees before it would host 4,500 migrants. He also suggested the EU consider training and equipping a force of Syrians to return home to take back their homeland. Seven international aid groups are proposing a new deal, financial investment rather than more economic aid, to ease migrant pressure on the EU.
Jan Egeland spoke on behalf of the groups at the G20 conference following the terrorist attacks on Paris. Egeland is head of the Norwegian Refugee Council and a former UN relief coordinator. Egeland proposed a Marshall Plan of reconstruction to create jobs to support long-term development programs in Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, and Turkey. Greek authorities have rescued more than 1,200 refugees and migrants in the Aegean Sea over the past 3 days. Greece remains the major route for those from the Middle East seeking asylum in Europe. Also, 15 Sudanese migrants died and 8 were seriously wounded yesterday when they were caught in the crossfire between Egyptian security forces and Bedouin smugglers near the Israeli border. 8 more migrants were arrested by Egyptian authorities in the incident. The violence indicates renewed efforts by migrants to enter Israel at a border point 17 kilometers from Rafah, an Egyptian town on the border of the Gaza Strip. Israel's Interior Ministry says more than 45,000 African migrants and asylum seekers, including many Sudanese, are in Israel.
Following Friday's terrorist attacks in Paris, questions are being raised about whether the violence will affect Europe's migrant and refugee crisis. Bruno Stagno is Deputy Executive Director of Human Rights Watch. He's responsible for the group's global advocacy. From Paris, Stagno spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the impact of the attacks.
Unfortunately, some people are, I guess, drawing the false conclusions that somehow the refugee flows represents an increased terrorist threat for Europe or for France. We firmly believe that the evidence, in fact, shows quite the opposite. We've had a historic number of refugees and asylum seekers coming to seek protection in Europe because they are fleeing a murderous regime led by Bashar al-Assad, and they're also fleeing the intolerance, the violence, and the murder and terror of the Islamic State in Syria and also in Iraq. And these people are victims. They have had their rights, liberties, and just the capacity to lead normal lives uprooted. They have been victims of the sectarian violence, parabombs, chemical weapons, terrorism. And these are people that are looking for international protection in Europe. And we don't see any evidence of them in any way representing a threat for Europe.
What about the fear factor? When you have a situation like this, people don't always think logically. You've presented your set of facts talking about that these refugees and migrants really don't pose the threat, but the fear remains. How do you deal with that?
Well, that's where we need, I think, the media, political leaders, civil society to play a responsible role, not to seek opportunistic gains from false narratives that are against the evidence. The information we have available as of today indicates that those that planned and led and actually executed the terrorist attacks here in Paris last Friday were basically raised and born in Europe, either in France or in Belgium. So the indication that this was basically due to refugees, frankly, lead us to false conclusions.
Now, even before the attacks, Human Rights Watch had called upon European governments to take urgent action to bring Europe's response to the refugee challenge under control. What would you like to see done?
We've been advocating with Europe for a number of issues. First, we want robust search and rescue operations to continue on the Mediterranean and the Aegean Seas in order for refugees and asylum seekers not to fall prey to gangs, smugglers, traffickers, and to capsize in unsafe boats. Secondly, we want the EU to fix its broken asylum and refugee system. Thirdly, we want a more equitable distribution of asylum seekers amongst the 28 members of the EU so that all of them take some degree of responsibility. Fourthly, we want them to concentrate in giving priority to those that actually come from unsafe countries so that their claims can be processed first and foremost. Since there are important backlogs in the way these applications are being processed, we would like those coming from Syria, from Iraq, from Afghanistan, and Eritrea to be given priority status so that their claims can be processed first. And last but not least, there should be greater investment in terms of resources for the European Refugee Agency and increased assistance to the United Nations Refugee Agency for its own camps in Lebanon, Jordan, and elsewhere.
Human Rights Watch also has concerns about new anti-terrorism legislation. Would you tell us about that?
Well, I guess an element that's related to all of this is, of course, violations that are committed in the name of countering terrorism. And we are quite critical of recent legislation adopted, for example, here in France, which is extremely intrusive in terms of mass surveillance of basically everybody under the presumption that that will lead to enhanced or improved counterterrorism effort. And we have seen, once again, no evidence. And those that are leading the efforts for a more intrusive mass surveillance basically have had difficulty in showing how monitoring and surveilling people has actually led them to identify cases in which broad, unfocused surveillance has made a decisive difference.
Bruno Stagno is Deputy Executive Director of Human Rights Watch. From Paris, Stagno spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
In France, a nation in mourning went back to work today, hours after authorities carried out strikes against Islamic State groups targets in Syria. Meanwhile, a manhunt continues for a suspected 8 assailants and other accomplices in Europe's worst terrorist attacks in more than a decade. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
As French strikes destroyed Islamic State group sites in the Syrian city of Raqqa Sunday night, French police carried out dozens of raids in several towns across the country. French and Belgian police are also trying to track down 26-year-old Salah Abdeslam, the suspected 8th assailant in Friday's terrorist attacks that killed at least 129 people around Paris. Authorities believe one of Abdeslam's brothers was one of the suicide bombers. Belgian authorities are reportedly holding another brother. News has emerged the Brussels-born Abdeslam slipped past French police early Saturday as he crossed into Belgium in a car carrying three men. Belgian police have also made other arrests in a gritty Brussels neighborhood called Molenbeek that is home to many Arab immigrants. More details are also emerging about another assailant, Frenchman Omar Ismail Mustafai, who lived outside Paris and who apparently tipped into radical Islam in 2010. According to reports, some of the French searches are preventative measures against potential radicals, but at least one in the Paris suburb of Bobigny is reported to be directly linked to Friday's attacks.
Le terrorisme peut frapper.
Speaking on the radio Monday morning, French Prime Minister Manuel Valls said authorities are aware that more attacks were being prepared. He said raids are being carried out to question people who support radical Islam and advocate hatred for the French Republic. Meanwhile, there are reports that Iraqi officials warned France and other nations of imminent attacks. Hundreds of young French have left to join radical movements in Iraq and Syria in recent years, and authorities say that more than 100 have been killed there. Hundreds more suspected radicals are still in France, some with links to jihadi fighters in the Middle East. ISIS has claimed responsibility for Friday's attacks, and French authorities say the multiple strikes were prepared abroad with assailants mobilized in Belgium with possible complicity in France. January's terrorist attacks in Paris also had links to extremists in the Middle East. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
At least 4 people died in shootings and explosions in several neighborhoods in Burundi's capital yesterday. Police in Bujumbura say one officer was killed, while another officer and 2 civilians were injured in a nighttime attack on a police post in the Mutakara district. A municipal official in the capital's Mukaza district says 3 more people died last night in separate shooting incidents. Also, Bujumbura Mayor Freddy Mbonimpa says about 10 people attacked his home in the Rahero district last night with gunfire and grenades. No injuries or deaths were reported. The mayor is a member of the ruling party. Despite sanctions and threats of UN military intervention, violence continues over the third-term re-election of President Pierre Nkurunziza. Mr. Nkurunziza's foreign minister told VOA yesterday that the president is prepared to enter dialogue with the opposition. At least 240 people have been killed and more than 200,000 have fled the country since the opposition took to the streets to protest the May election. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 21 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. At least 4 people died in shootings and explosions in several neighborhoods in Burundi's capital yesterday. And in France, a nation in mourning went back to work today, hours after authorities carried out strikes against Islamic State group targets in Syria. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
A 5-year-old girl has become the first diagnosed and successfully treated patient of the highly virulent form of tuberculosis known as XDR-TB in the United States. Johns Hopkins Children's Center specialist in Baltimore, Maryland, treated the child after diagnosing her with XDR-TB when she was 2 years old. The researchers said the virus is resistant to most known TB drugs and made it very challenging to treat, especially in children under 5. Dr. Sanjay Jain and Dr. Nicole Parrish are pediatricians and TB experts at the Johns Hopkins Children's Center. While they say they are thrilled that their patient is now doing well, both doctors caution the case is a wake-up call to the realities of TB. Dr. Nicole Parrish first describes how the patient was presented to them.
She presented with fever at the end of 3 months' stay in India, and initially her clinical symptoms, the fever, her chest x-ray, were all very consistent with tuberculosis. But it was very difficult for us to actually isolate the bug. And that actually took several months before we could be certain that she, one, had tuberculosis, and then what kinds of medications we'd be able to use to cure her tuberculosis.
Just to add, you know, the way we found out that this was XDR was by some tests which were done at Hopkins, where they incubate the bacteria with the antibiotic, as well as some other tests which were done at outside labs, including the CDC, where they actually look for mutations in the DNA of the bug, and some of these mutations correlate with resistance to known drugs. It took us 12 weeks after she was initially diagnosed with TB to know that this was XDR-TB.
Once you all made the diagnosis of XDR-TB, what were some of the challenges that you faced in treating the young child?
I think that's a great question, and the answer to that is that there were multiple challenges, first being what drugs to use. Unlike a lot of other forms of TB, there are no clear drug cocktails or regimens that are used. It's an individualized plan. So there are not a lot of drugs that have been tested, or I should say, we don't know the concentration of the drugs that they would achieve when we give them standard dosing in children. The term medically used is pharmacokinetics. So there were a lot of drugs that we didn't have information for young children in. And then the third thing, which was complicated, was the fact that a lot of these drugs, even though they were available, were not available in what we term as child-friendly formulation. So, you know, a small kid, a three-year-old or a two-year-old, cannot take pills. And so that was the other issue that was brought up, and, you know, we tried to solve it in some ways. And finally, one other last thing that was pretty problematic was that we needed to find a way to figure out that this kid was actually getting better with the new cocktail that we had given for XDR-TB, and there were no real standard markers, and so we had to use some innovation and unconventional use of already existing technology, which is CT imaging.
What was the total treatment time for this patient?
So 18 months of directly observed therapy is kind of what we say, 20 months of total treatment, but about 18 months of what we call is directly observed therapy.
You say now it appears that she is doing well. So is there any chance that the disease could come back?
I'm sure there is a chance that the disease can come back. I mean, we think that likelihood is low. It's not zero. And the child will be monitored for almost 2 years after completion of treatment.
And there was no one else in her family who caught the disease from her?
Definitely. Nobody in her immediate family caught the disease.
Looking at this particular case, what would you say some of the biggest things that you learned from it that other doctors will be able to use in their countries?
That's actually an excellent question. Again, to me, this is a wake-up call. And I think we as pediatricians specifically feel that TB in general, but definitely drug-resistant forms of TB, are underdiagnosed in children, and that's because it's so difficult to diagnose. So this case highlights, you know, when we have all the resources here at Johns Hopkins, it took us 3 months to figure out that this was a drug-resistant strain. So I think the biggest big-picture thing that this case highlights is that there is a big problem. It's underreported. You know, it highlights the need to focus on this issue. So what will I tell the clinicians out there? Well, try harder to make sure that we try to culture young children and try to get bugs so that we can test for drug resistance. I know it's not easy because resources are limited in developing worlds, but that's one message that comes across. I think the other message that comes across is that we need to do a lot more treatment and research to understand what and how we're going to treat these patients and monitor these patients. And I think this sounds a bit self-serving because both me and Nicole work in the field of pediatric TB, but I really think more research has to be focused on pediatric-specific treatment as well as monitoring for children. And an example is that we had to use something which is not conventionally used to monitor this patient.
That was Dr. Sanjay Jain and Dr. Nicole Parrish, pediatricians and TB experts at the Johns Hopkins Children's Center. They spoke with me from Baltimore, Maryland.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, exceptional future leaders will gather for this year's World Bank's Youth Summit to tell the story of young people's role in the fight against climate change. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests discussing how youth can inspire communities everywhere to take action. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
My name is Edward Ameyibo. I listen to Daybreak Africa to be abreast with developments on the continent. I encourage you to do the same.
You can also be a part of the show through our listener's mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on The Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. At least four people died in shootings and explosions in several neighborhoods in Burundi's capital yesterday. And in France, a nation in mourning went back to work today, hours after authorities carried out strikes against Islamist State group targets in Syria. Coming up, music from the DRC, and in our feature segment, as a result of flooding and drought, Malawi faces its worst flood shortage in years. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheyas Wuhi, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday, Kim, and sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off today with African football.
Kim, let's kick off once again with African football. 14 World Cup qualifying matches are scheduled across the continent on Tuesday as teams try to make it to the next stage on the road to Russia 2018. By the end of Tuesday's action, we'll know the 20 African teams that have made it to the final qualifying round. Those 20 teams will be divided into five groups of four each. And when all is said and done, VOA World Cup fans, the top team in each of the five African qualifying groups will book a much-coveted ticket to the 2018 World Cup in Russia. In African qualifying over the weekend, six teams advanced to the final stage after winning their home and away series on goal aggregate. They are, in alphabetical order, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Gabon, Guinea, Morocco, Uganda, and Zambia. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma says the Cranes of Uganda eliminated Togo.
Uganda outclassed Togo 3-0 in the return leg of their second round Africa 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifier in Kampala on Sunday. Uganda prevailed on a 4-0 aggregate. Zambia beat Sudan 2-0 to progress on a 3-0 advantage. Guinea dismissed Namibia 2-0 to win on a 3-0 aggregate. The Democratic Republic of Congo and Burundi drew 2-2. The Congolese go ahead on a 5-4 advantage. Equatorial Guinea pipped Morocco 1-0. However, Morocco advanced on a 2-1 aggregate. Gabon pipped Mozambique 4-3 in a post-match penalty shootout after they tied 1-1 on aggregate.
Thanks, Mark. That's Mark Ouma of our Daybreak Africa radio show, which you can hear Monday through Friday on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com. VOA!
I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America!
I also encourage our Voice of America listeners to follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at VOA Sunny Sports. In one of the World Cup qualifiers in Africa on Tuesday, Ghana will host the Comoros Islands. Reporter Kwabena Quicksilver Ofori has this preview for us from Kumasi.
The Black Stars of Ghana will welcome their Comoros counterparts to the Baba Yara Stadium for their decider. In their first leg game last Friday, the Black Stars were tied to a draw at the Sheikh Said Mohammed Sports Stadium in Morore. The Kumasi game is predicted by many Ghanaian soccer fans a convincing victory for Ghana. But disappointed Black Stars committee chairman George Afriye admits Comoros were a tough side in the first leg, and the African Giants could not make the second round a mere formality, and a draw in Kumasi will see Ghana eliminated from the 2018 World Cup qualifier. Meanwhile, Black Stars coach Avram Grant took his team through a vigorous training yesterday at Baba Yara Stadium and continued this morning to get his side ready for the encounter. In another development, the Kumasi fans who rejected and booed the Black Stars in a game last year after the Brazil 2014 fiasco have pledged their full support for the team and are ready to cheer them to victory come tomorrow. For the Sunny Side of Sports, Kwabena Fori in Kumasi.
Voice of America!
I'm VOA Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. Well, it's been a very impressive debut season for Didier Drogba in Major League Soccer. The VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shagun Dot on the spot Adeyemi, has an update on the Ivorian star, as well as other football news.
Good evening, Africa. Didier Drogba, who plays for Montreal Impact in the Major League Soccer, MLS, has dismissed suggestions that spending time in London during the MLS break will pave the way for another return to English Premiership club Chelsea. The 37-year-old striker moved to the MLS after his second spell at the Stamford Bridge Club. But while Drogba was open to the idea of training with Chelsea to maintain his fitness, he does not envisage becoming the latest player to sign a short-term deal with a European club while the MLS is on break. The former Ivory Coast captain scored an impressive 12 goals in 14 appearances for Montreal. And acting FIFA president Issa Hayatou is continuing in his post despite undergoing a kidney transplant. A statement from the World Soccer's governing body on Friday said Hayatou has long suffered from a renal insufficiency. He said, however, that the situation has not prevented him from fully performing his duties at the world and African football governing bodies without interruption. He will continue to fulfill his role as acting FIFA president as intended, FIFA says. The 69-year-old Cameroonian, who is also the head of the Confederation of African Football, has been running FIFA since Sepp Blatter was suspended for 90 days last month. Ironically, Blatter, too, has been undergoing medical treatment for stress. The 79-year-old was in hospital for several days with a condition that was not considered serious. He was discharged on Wednesday. In other news, the German national soccer team was back home on Saturday after spending Friday night at the Stade de France because of the terror attacks in Paris that left over 100 people dead. The World Cup winners had been due to return to their hotel after playing the friendly game against France, but stayed inside the stadium after two explosions went off outside during the game. Germany is due to play the Netherlands in Hanover on Tuesday, but has delayed its journey. Meanwhile, as France grappled with the aftermath of another terrorist attack, organizers of the European Soccer Championship faced renewed concerns about how to protect fans attending 51 matches in 10 stadiums around the country next year. Friday night's deadly bloodshed started when two explosions went off outside Stade de France during the national team's match against Germany. The same stadium will host the tournament's opening game on June 10th and the final 1 month later. The European tournament is held every 4 years. It is second in global prestige, only to the World Cup. With 24 teams involved across 10 venues, the risks are enormous and the fans severely exposed to danger inside and outside stadiums.
Thanks, Segun. That's the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Segun Dot, on the spot at Ayemi, reporting from Lagos, Nigeria. And I know Segun and the millions of other Nigerian football fans in Africa's most populous country will be closely following Tuesday's Nigeria-Swaziland World Cup qualifier. The teams played to a goalless draw in the first leg in Lobamba, Swaziland. I think the Super Eagles will spread their wings on Tuesday and advance to that final qualifying round in Africa. During Monday's Africa 54 television show, I have a segment on Kenyan athletics. Russia's recent suspension from World Athletics for doping violations has raised concern in Kenya that the East African distance running power could also face sanctions. In Kenya's lush Rift Valley region, which has produced some of the world's greatest distance runners, athletes and coaches say they're worried about possible penalties from the IAAF, the governing body for international athletics. In the last few years, more than 30 Kenyan runners have failed drug tests, including Rita Jeptu, winner of the Boston and Chicago marathons. At this year's World Championships in Beijing, Kenya topped the medals table for the first time, but that achievement was tarnished a bit when the IAAF said two Kenyan athletes failed doping tests. Kenya's former world record holder in the marathon, Wilson Kipsang, is one of the athletes I spotlight in Monday's Africa 54 TV segment. Kipsang says, and I quote, "If the Kenyan Athletics Federation is not strict enough and not ready enough to intervene on the doping issue, I think the IAAF will really take action." And then Kipsang continues, "If the IOC takes action and maybe bans Kenya, it will be so unfortunate to Kenya and to athletes." And I know Wilson Kipsang is one of those Kenyan athletes hoping to compete at next year's Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, as a result of floods and drought, Malawi faces its worst food shortages in years. And next, ensuring the right of indigenous groups to their land and community forests. But first, some music. Here is Awilo Logoba from the DRC with Gete Le Coin.
Mwende, Rafa!
Logoba from the DRC with Getelecon.
Well, as a result of floods and drought, Malawi faces its worst food shortages in 5 years. The UN World Food Program is offering aid, but resources are being strained and schools may be affected. Lamek Messina in Malawi has more.
Tisungane Lawrence goes to school on an empty stomach. The maize harvest was poor this year.
Here we do not have enough to eat and children go to school with no breakfast. There were floods followed by a dry spell and that affected the crops.
The World Food Program was planning food aid for 2.5 million Malawians, but the crisis is straining resources and could threaten its school feeding program. The UN agency introduced school feeding in Malawi 15 years ago. Nearly a million Malawi primary school students benefit from the program that includes morning porridge.
Once I take porridge, I regain strength and I am able to concentrate on what the teacher is teaching us in class.
Even in good years, the WFP says school feeding is a safety net for the families during the lean season. Now, with this crisis, it is essential.
We should be scaling up school feeding at this time. Unfortunately, the funding on that part is also quite constrained. So we have a very difficult situation.
She says school feeding keeps parents from pulling kids out of school when food and money are tight.
They not only learn, they get a meal, a nutritious meal. They also can be avoided from some of the negative coping strategies, which we know unfortunately take place through early marriages, pregnancy.
For now, Tisungani's grandmother raises pigs and has started brewing beer to make extra money while Tisungani and his seven cousins go to school.
That was Lamech Messina reporting.
The World Resources Institute says ensuring the right of indigenous groups to manage their land and community forests is a key way to combating deforestation and climate change. Peter Veit, director of WRI's Land and Resources Rights Initiative, tells Ricky Shryock that governments can achieve their climate targets by protecting community forests. Veit spoke ahead of next month's Paris Climate Conference.
In many parts of the world, particularly in Africa, land is held collectively by communities or indigenous people. And our work has focused on the land that includes forests. And so community forests are that part of community land, or the commons, if you like, that include forests on them.
How does WRI then think it can help stop deforestation in places like West Africa with programs like community forest tenure?
So our interests are to conduct research, policy research, and to review legislation, draft bills, and to share some of the policy recommendations that come out of that analysis. We also develop tools that community leaders, government officials, donor agencies can use in helping them make more evidence-based decisions. With regard to this economic assessment that we've done, our real interest is in reaching finance ministers and donor agencies and encourage them to look at the results of this research, and hopefully that will sway them to invest more in securing collective rights because of both the economic and the environmental benefits that come from secure tenure.
What are some of the challenges to having countries achieve secure tenure?
Our land reform is not easy to do. It's politically charged. Land is such a source of wealth and therefore source of power in so many countries around the world. So getting a reform on land is not a simple task. There are a lot of stakeholders involved. For communities and indigenous people in particular, the way that they manage their land is that they oftentimes allocate a portion of their land for use by the community as a whole, the so-called common or common property within community lands. And that land is usually forest lands or wetlands or rivers and streams or pastures, and they're meant to be used by everyone that's a member of that community. Many governments view that land as underutilized and view that land as vacant, idle, and therefore available for investment. So it's that land that's most at risk from expropriation. It's most at risk to be allocated to investors, and it's very often not recognized by the state as community land. They will recognize land that is community land that's used as homesteads and family farms, but they don't recognize the land that is managed as common property usually.
That was World Resources Institute Director Peter Veit talking to VOA's Ricky Shryock. This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Shaogun Chung, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The ambassadors of the United States of America, the Netherlands, Norway, Finland, Sweden, Germany, and Denmark, along with the High Commissioners for the United Kingdom and Canada, in a joint statement issued on November 4th, once again underscored their strong and ongoing support for a vibrant, free, and independent civil society in Kenya. In this context, the statement read, "We welcome the decision by the government of Kenya to suspend the Non-Governmental Organizations Coordination Board's October 29th notice that it intends to cancel the registration certificates of 959 Kenyan NGOs. The original decision announced by the board raised serious concerns and questions about regulation of the sector." The signatories noted that, "As international partners, we are fully committed to supporting appropriate transparency and accountability with regard to NGOs. However, we also believe that regulation must be fair, reasonable, and justly administered. We urge the board to ensure all NGOs have timely information and an adequate opportunity to answer any questions or address concerns. We, as donors, require detailed financial reports and regular audits from NGOs that we partner with, and insist on transparency and accountability in our ongoing oversight. We have no evidence that NGOs to which we provide donor funds are supporting or funding terrorism or are engaged in other illegal activity." The government signatory to the joint statement strongly support the rights to freedom of expression, peaceful assembly, and association for civil society as is guaranteed in the Constitution of Kenya, and firmly believe that a strong civil society is vital to protecting fundamental rights, strengthening democratic institutions, building prosperity, and ensuring security. NGOs provide a wide range of essential services to Kenyans, including in health care and education. The government's issuing the statement again urged the government of Kenya to implement as soon as possible the Public Benefit Organizations Act of 2013, which provides an excellent framework for the regulation of civil society organizations, while at the same time ensuring transparency and accountability in the sector's work.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Let's Talk, husband and wife grooming. Does it matter? Or do you just let yourself go and say, "I am married"? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing husband and wife grooming. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.